Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, more deadly police shootings and protests. New York and New Jersey rocked by bombs. Chaos in Syria. Obama at the UN. Tear gas, violence, and the National Guard out in Charlotte. Last night, protesters demanded video footage of a deadly police shooting Tuesday be released.
We want the tape! We want the tape! We want the tape!
In New York, after the apprehension of bombing suspect Ahmad Khan Rahami, New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill said the city is looking for answers.
Now that we have this suspect in custody, the investigation can focus on other aspects, such as whether this individual acted alone and what his motivations may have been.
And President Obama made his final address to the United Nations General Assembly.
We all face a choice. We can choose to press forward with a better model of cooperation and integration, or we can retreat into a world sharply divided.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Janelle Ross, Yoki Driesen, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the latest round of police shootings and protests, in the New York and New Jersey bombings, in Syria? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Janelle Ross, political reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome back, Janelle.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, it's great to have you here. Also from Washington, Yoki Driesen, deputy managing editor and foreign editor for Vox. Yoki, great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Janelle, and Yoki.
Quite something in Charlotte this week. National Guard out, tear gas out, lots of protesters out. Here's a woman out protesting on the streets on Wednesday night, speaking directly to the police who were standing in a line across the street in riot gear.
We can't call you to protect us. We have to protect ourselves. We have to protect ourselves. 7 months pregnant, and I'm out here protecting myself.
Keith Scott is dead. Here's Charlotte Police Chief Kerr Putney talking with reporters yesterday, said the video, which has not been released to the public yet, of Keith Scott's fatal shooting would not be released to the public. He said in the videos he did not clearly, or to him, did not clearly show Scott holding a gun.
The video does not give me absolute, definitive, visual evidence that would confirm that a person is pointing a gun. I did not see that in the videos that I've reviewed.
Janelle Ross, we have charges against a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In Charlotte, we have 3 nights now of protests. Last night, more peaceful. The National Guard out and still no video released. Across the country and in Charlotte, what do you see unfolding here, Janelle?
It seems a combination of things are happening at once. You know, we have this intriguing convergence of, the growing availability of technology that allows all sorts of people to record all sorts of events. Mm-hmm. But there is still the ever-present hand of government and the government's ability, when they so desire, to withhold information from the public. And in this case, in North Carolina, there is also an impending law that is due to go into effect in October that would likely shield this sort of video from public view going forward permanently. So there are a combination of things. In addition to that, of course, there is this spate of police shootings in which mostly black men, but certainly many other people have been killed by police. However, of course, that is all we know because we have not seen the video at this point.
I mean, Jack, when you hear the police chief there say that he doesn't want to impede the investigation of this by putting the video out, does that make sense to you, or does it appear a lack of transparency, or are we at risk of the video confusing more than it illuminates? I mean, you would think if there's a video, people would want to see it.
You would. Martin Costi today on Morning Edition on NPR made the point that there is a kind of conflict in the procedures and in the law between transparency and privacy. And he put this in that context, and he said that the fear of law enforcement officials and others is that videos will sort of spoil the minds of jurors and pollute the pool. And, you know, essentially, once it's on the internet, you can never find a fair jury. So there is that consideration. That may be part of what he's feeling, a kind of loyalty to his police corps. But whatever the reason, it certainly seems short-sighted next to the necessity of doing everything one can to tamp down the violent edge of the protest.
Yogi Drizin, we just feel flooded in recent months with these videos coming out of these terrible shootings. And it is hard to discern sometimes exactly what's going on, who's in the right, who's in the wrong, but we see who has ended up dead on the ground. And in many of these, very big questions around those. But the flood of video released, many released, I mean, even if they haven't put the whole thing out, we've seen a lot, shots down from the helicopter, shots from the ground. This is becoming a part of American news fare, it seems, all the time, Yoki.
And I think what's interesting is that it's becoming part of what we see, not simply because journalists maybe happen to be in a place and record something, or because police officers record something, but also because average people standing nearby record something. We all remember the Facebook live stream of a woman literally streaming the shooting death of the person she loves, Eric Garner. That was videotaped by people who were standing nearby who were not journalists. So you have these videos pop up, and it strikes me that's interesting, not just because there are so many of them, but also because of where they come from. This is something which is now such a part of our daily life that a person can't act and assume that it's not going to be seen. At the same time, these videos sometimes complicate things as well, because the narrative, which is so tragic and so often the case of late, is that the victims are black men, often unarmed. But the shooters are not always white cops. And I think that it's often shorthanded into white police shoot black people. The black people are getting shot, in some cases, as the case was in Charlotte. The shooter was himself black. So we are seeing more video, we're seeing more victims, but the narrative of who's the victimizer is, I think, not as easy as it's often seen to be.
Janelle, what about the responses here in Tulsa? And of course, these are different events, these are different shootings, these are different people involved, but we already have first-degree manslaughter charges against the police officer there. This was Betty Shelby in the shooting in Tulsa. Does that look like just different circumstances of evidence? Does it look like a different strategy on handling a case and the public volatility of it? How do you see it, Janelle?
Again, I think perhaps there's a combination of things happening here. I think I want to go back to one point. I think, as everyone is well aware, this is not an entirely new phenomenon, but of course there is growing public awareness of this phenomenon. And I think because of that, public officials around the country are in different ways and to different degrees under some pressure to prove or demonstrate that the justice system functions for all. And of course, there is also in the backdrop of all of these incidents and each of these shootings is the fact that very few police officers are actually prosecuted and even fewer are convicted. So it is certainly rare. And I think it could be said objectively, this is an extremely swift movement towards charges. And there may be, you know, only the prosecutor can say with certainty, but there may be a variety of reasons for that. As you said, there are some specific details in terms of what happened in the Tulsa incident. But also, at this point, the video of what happened there is public, and it is going to be more difficult to engage in a conversation about uncertainty or a lack of an inability to tell exactly what happened when people watching television or, you know, surfing the internet can see for themselves what occurred.
We had less than a week after Terrence Crutcher's fatal shooting there in Tulsa, these charges, manslaughter charges against police officer Betty Jo Shelby. Here was Crutcher's twin sister, Tiffany, saying yesterday, even with the charges, she's prepared for a big legal fight.
We're demanding full prosecution. We want a conviction. And when that happens, this is a small victory. But we know we got to get ready to fight this war.
And then, of course, it rolls right into the red hot politics of this moment. On Wednesday in Orlando, Florida, Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton talked about the recent shootings in Tulsa, in Charlotte,
There is still much we don't know about what happened in both incidents, but we do know that we have two more names to add to a list of African Americans killed by police officers in these encounters. It's unbearable, and it needs to become intolerable.
Unbearable, intolerable. Donald Trump, well, a similar but very differently voiced view of what's going on. Here he was in Pittsburgh yesterday saying he would not tolerate any more like what we've seen.
The violence against our citizens and our law enforcement must be brought to a very rapid end. Every single American in our country is entitled to live in a safe community.
But the first violence he was talking about there was the protests. What about the political response, Janelle, that we've seen to these shootings?
It, too, has certainly been intriguing. We have a situation where one candidate has really made a very almost Nixonian law and order sort of message a central part of his campaign. And for him, the images of unrest in cities around the country and increased frustrations and tensions between police and communities is frankly beneficial for those who share his view and those who are already in his camp or inclined to lean that way. It probably will not help him to expand his coalition or the group of people who are uncertain or deeply opposed to Donald Trump's, political thought and his solutions for America. And on the other side, Secretary Clinton has certainly, through the course of her campaign, expressed pretty consistent concern about policing issues and the way that particular communities are policed.
Concern, sometimes these days, feels like too mild a recipe for what's going on out there. On the other hand, you've got the sort of law and order crackdown message from Donald Trump, and who knows where that goes. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Protest in Charlotte, terror in New York, New Jersey, chaos in Syria, bombing of a relief convoy as a very fragile and patchy ceasefire came to an end in this last week. Janelle Ross is with us from the Washington Post, political reporter there. Yoki Driesen is with us, deputy managing editor, foreign editor at Vox. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us as well. What do you see in the police shootings and or protests that we've seen in the last week and much more at this point? What about the videos? Does full transparency mean releasing the videos? And how do we stop lone wolf bombings like New York? Lone wolf, we think. We'll learn more about that as the investigations go on. Chicago, thinking about all of its violence and out today with a new three-part plan from Mayor Rahm Emanuel there. He says it's about enforcement, investment, and prevention, but their numbers are big and bad. Donald Trump, at a Fox and Friends town hall meeting on Wednesday, one of the participants, Ricardo, asked him what he would do to stop violence in the black community. Trump said that he would use stop and frisk.
Well, one of the things I'd do, Ricardo, is I would do stop and frisk. I think you have to. We did it in New York. It worked incredibly well. And you have to be proactive.
Have to be proactive, says Donald Trump. Of course, there's been a court ruling saying that that has gone too far, that you've got problems with constitutionality there. Bryce in Flint, Michigan, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I love your show, first of all. And I'm so glad that you have someone from Vox, because they did a great article about how profiling works. And if you know, I've been the victim of profiling. I proved it in court. And if you target certain communities and certain ethnicities, you guarantee the statistics, which are touted by people like Mr. Trump. And if you look at the statistics of, for instance, frisk and stop, or stop and frisk, it didn't work. You know, only I think like 5% of people who were stopped, most of whom were, you know, African-American or Latino, had done anything. And I'll also point out the gentleman in Baltimore who was stopped 30 times over the course of 4 years and wasn't even issued a traffic ticket. And that's my basic point, is that there are three P's: prejudice, profiling, and policing.
What's supposed to happen then, Bryce? What's supposed to happen? Look at Chicago. They've got such a terrible problem there. Donald Trump points to that and says, we've got to do something dramatic here. What do you say, Bryce?
Well, I say, I mean, I heard a very interesting program. I think the woman was in Baltimore who followed several families and how policing worked for those families. And she mentioned how children were stopped at as early as 10 years old. They became part of the criminal system. And it just became this whole sort of thing where it's like, okay, there's Reggie. We know he's a bad kid, but stop him again. And that becomes his relationship with the police. And let me add also, I live in a nice middle-class black neighborhood where I grew up.
Okay.
And we always had police living in the neighborhood. And I think that's a big difference as well. It's not just being involved in the community. It's that we don't have as many police living in the communities.
Let us pick it up, Bryce. I mean, there's a point at which this bleeds over into the conversation about terror attacks this week. And, of course, we saw New York and New Jersey. Donald Trump on community policing of his stripe means stop and frisk. He also said, I mean, our caller talks about profiling. He said, well, let's do profiling as well if that helps us get on top of the problems.
They'll profile. They profile. They see somebody that's suspicious. They will profile. They will take that person in. They'll check out. Do we have a choice? Look what's going on. Do we really have a choice?
And he's talking about Israel there, profiling in Israel. Yoki Driesen, do we have a contest of visions about how to move forward here between Trump and Clinton when it comes to problems of crime, race relations, even terror at a certain point? Is it bring down the heavy law and order hammer with Donald Trump versus social programs with Clinton? Is it that clear?
I think that there is a divide, but I would frame it slightly differently. Donald Trump frames almost everything in the context of war. Even when he talks about crime, he's begun using a phrase that being in a black part of an American city is more dangerous than Afghanistan. Yeah. I've lived in Afghanistan, and that's, of course, absurd. He's tried to then clarify that what he means is it's more dangerous to be in Chicago than to be an American soldier in Afghanistan, which is also not true. But to him, everything is framed through the lens of war. It's war on terror. It's war on crime. It's flood the streets. It's use stop and frisk, which, as the caller pointed out, has had clearly shown racial bias. But Hillary Clinton frames it differently. To her, it's in large part a law enforcement measure. And that's kind of a fundamental divide. Is terrorism, in particular, something we should think of as war? Or do we look at attacks like the one in New York, the one in Chelsea, and treat them as law enforcement, something where the FBI would try to stop it as compared to the military, the CIA trying to kill the person ahead of time? And I think that's the divide. The divide between, especially when it comes to terrorism, is it war or is it law enforcement?
Jack, a political season, of course, can ratchet everything up, the emotions around everything that we're seeing. But the realities are being drawn in very, very stark terms lately. I mean, I've heard this echoed from the streets of Charlotte this week. Young black men there talking about a war, and finally you see it, everybody, because the TV cameras are here and we're out in the street. There is something about the ratcheting and ratcheting in the streets and in our political dialogue here that seems it's reaching a point that it's darned high, Jack.
It's darned high, and it's darned advantageous, at least ostensibly, for Mr. Trump. Fear is his, really, his main issue, and stirring it up is part of his the recipe for his success. So it's useful to take to step back and look at some statistics. The Cato Institute, which is funded by the Koch brothers largely, issued these statistics recently. There have been 800,000 refugees admitted to the country since 2001. None have perpetrated a domestic terrorist attack. The Cato people found that the chances of being murdered by a refugee terrorist in the U.S., that is 1 in 3.6 billion. The odds of being killed by an illegal immigrant, also a target of Mr. Trump, that is 1 in 10 billion. So the Mr. Trump's constant effort to, yes, he uses the metaphor of war, but even more, he magnifies. And, you know, the black neighborhoods are war zones, and we're America's survival is at stake, he has said, in containing domestic terrorism. That needs to be checked against the sober reality.
Of course, we had that this week where he was talking about Trump, about American African-American communities being their worst shape ever at a rally in Kenansville, North Carolina. Here he was.
Our African-American communities are absolutely in the worst shape that they've ever been in before, ever, ever, ever. You take a look at the inner cities, you get no education, you get no jobs, You get shot walking down the street. They're worse. I mean, honestly, places like Afghanistan are safer than some of our inner cities.
Janelle Ross, what did you make of that characterization by candidate nominee Trump?
I would say the same thing that it seems to have been for several weeks now. This is his ostensible appeal to African-American voters and what he's describing as an incredibly dystopian and, as Jack mentioned, not terribly factual depiction of life for most Black Americans. Or any Americans, for that matter.
Are things worse than they've ever been?
Well, that is really objectively an unreasonable thing to say. You know, Mr. Trump said this in a city named after a man who was the son of a major slave-owning family. So this is just not a reasonable assessment of the facts. And I think, you know, honestly, these are notions about Black life and life in urban areas that might sound accurate or familiar to people who do not live there or who are motivated themselves, as Jack mentioned, by some degree of fear of these communities and the people who live in them. And if this is a major element of your politics and your reasoning for supporting certain policies or candidates, then this is a message that's going to be very attractive and sounds quite accurate. But it is not.
Let me go to a caller from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We've got Ray calling. Ray, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I would like to disagree with you when you stated we're not at war in the inner cities. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, during the last year and a half, there have been two people burned. After they were shot, their bodies were lit on fire. Now, the Milwaukee police have not released the video yet. That is the root of the riot that happened here about 4 weeks ago. I'm telling you, Tom, all across this nation, the inner cities are at war with themselves and with the police, and the police are at war with them. And if we don't wake up to this, you need to walk in the footsteps of these little children who are trying to go to school this morning and have to dodge bullets.
I mean, we heard the characterization of the young men in the streets in Charlotte. That's what they called it. And they say the country now sees it when there are protests and the National Guard comes out and the cameras come in. Janelle, I mean, this is a caller who looks at Milwaukee, and Donald Trump's characterization sounds like it would resonate with him. Sounds like it lines up at some degree with his own observation.
Certainly, you know, I can't argue with the caller about what he feels that he sees or his sense of the community where he lives or perhaps lives near. And it is also certainly factually true that Milwaukee has one of the higher crime rates among major cities in the United States. This is true. However, I would have to say, writ large, violent crime has continued to fall. Violent crime is not, in fact, surging across the country. And as a Black person who lives in a city, I can say that while I, too, share concern for children who find themselves living in difficult neighborhoods, it is troubling to me to hear anyone describe an entire group of people perhaps at war with one another or with themselves, and to describe American cities as war zones. You know, I would say if that is your perspective, of course you have a right to that. But the question is, then what is the appropriate response? And if the answer is, as Mr. Trump has suggested, additional profiling, which has been shown in particular with regard to stop and frisk, if your suggestion is that police should employ tactics that have been shown to stop monumental numbers of completely innocent people, if you believe that that is going to improve police community relations, you can certainly vote accordingly. But there is ample evidence to show that that is not the case.
On the other hand, all of the events of these last week and weeks now make pretty clear that we don't want to go along on cruise control here. Ray, I appreciate your call from Milwaukee. Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Here's a part of the narrative that hasn't made it into the mainstream yet. We've been asking, how do we break the cycles, Tom, that you've asked about?
Yeah.
In the narrative the difference between Tulsa and Charlotte, what hasn't been talked about is the fact that the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, has been involved in racial reconciliation over the last 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. Look up the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation in Tulsa and the work that's been done at Oklahoma State University, where they've measured racial attitudes. The community has been in dialogue for about 6 or 7 years. The other piece I would say, relative to what we're seeing in the narrative coming out of Charlotte and why we need something other than crackdowns,
yep,
and law and order approaches, this is trauma. And it's a language that the criminal justice system does not understand yet. The role of trauma. Trauma that builds up over the course of decades, centuries, and generations. That's what you're seeing. And this acting out behavior, which no one agrees with, is traumatic. It's trauma-oriented.
Centuries of trauma. That is a lot to deal with, but of course history stands there, and we stand on the current end of it. Tom, let me hold that, if I may, and Yoki, turn to you on the terror bombings front this week. We saw this series of bombings, more sophisticated than we've seen in the past, a huge law enforcement response in New York, New Jersey, and then in pretty short order, an arrest. What have we learned at this point about the man and the motivation, if we know anything precise, Yoki, about behind these bombings?
What's been interesting is that the notebook that was recovered at his house that Mike McCall on Capitol Hill, the chairman of one of the House most powerful House committees, held it up, and there was a bullet hole and blood on it, which was really striking. But in it, Rahami spoke of two people and two groups. He referenced both ISIS and he referenced al-Qaeda. And when he referenced al-Qaeda, he referenced a specific person named Anwar al-Awlaki. Awlaki was an English-language, American-born propagandist who was killed a few years ago by an American drone strike in Yemen. And his words, spoken in English, relayed in English, mm-hmm, continued to radicalize years later. Nidal Hassan, who carried out the massacre at Fort Hood, referenced Anwar al-Awlaki. Now, years after that, you have someone who referenced the Islamic State, which, of course, didn't exist 5 years ago, but again, also referenced Anwar al-Awlaki. And we're seeing, I think, two things. One, it's so easy for a person to become radicalized, not because they've met someone in person, not because they're sitting in Afghanistan or Pakistan, but because they're sitting at home reading on the internet, seeing the writings, listening to the recordings of English speakers like al-Awlaki. And two, that once that is out there, once those kind of words are in the ether, they don't go away. It's not something where if you kill the person, as the U.S. did with this person, suddenly his message is gone. As we are now seeing, his message did not disappear and is still very dangerous.
It seems that this was a more sophisticated bomb than we saw in the Boston Marathon bombing, which he also referenced, I believe, in that notebook. Where does that learning come from? He spent time in Pakistan. Is it clear? Do we know? Is this lone wolf or is this potentially something more orchestrated?
The presumption right now in what law enforcement, as of this moment, continues to say is that they're trying to figure out where he went to Pakistan and who he met with, but that for the moment they believe they haven't yet found evidence that he was trained by the Islamic State, in contact with the Islamic State, supported by the Islamic State. They haven't closed the door on that. They haven't said definitively there were no others in the U.S. even that were supporting him. But right now the focus is less on he might have gotten something in Pakistan and more on what he learned here at home. And, you know, to your point, part of, again, we were talking earlier about narratives that take shape and are in some ways false. When this bomb thankfully did not kill people, the bomb in Chelsea, there was the narrative of, okay, he's just kind of bumbling. He's just an idiot who didn't know what he was doing. The New York Daily News headline was, "Martyr Dumb." In actuality, the reason that bomb in Chelsea didn't kill anybody was because he put it into a dumpster. And I spoke to bomb experts who universally said that had that bomb not been in a dumpster, if it had been on the street in a backpack, as was the case in Boston, you'd have had deaths, not just people wounded.
This was a bomb with more relation to the IEDs of the Middle East than we've seen in the past. Something beyond the pressure cooker bombs that we saw in Boston in the Marathon bombings. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Hollywood's golden couple Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt filed for divorce. Jimmy Fallon contemplated why.
It's kind of sad news, big news, that Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are separating. Yeah, it's pretty scary when even Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are like, eh, I can do better. And you go, no, you both.
On the website Funny or Die, Zach Galifianakis, host of Between Two Ferns, asked Hillary Clinton about what she and Donald Trump would be wearing to the debates.
Do you wonder what your opponent might be wearing? I mean, what do you...
I assume he'll wear, you know, that red power tie.
Or maybe like a white power tie.
That's even more appropriate.
Okay, and Sunday night, Julia Louis-Dreyfus won her sixth lead actress in a comedy Emmy. It was the fifth in a row. She won for portraying Selina Meyer on HBO's Veep.
I think that Veep has torn down the wall between comedy and politics. Our show started out as a political satire, but it now feels more like a sobering documentary.
Sad, but maybe a little bit true. Janelle Ross is with us from The Washington Post. Yoki Driesen's here, Deputy Managing Editor, Foreign Editor at Vox. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. How do we stop lone wolf bombings like New York? Is the U.S. right to keep talking with Russia about Syria? Is the U.S. being played as Syrians die? And what's the alternative there? What do you think on Donald Trump Jr. and Skittles? Are you glad for the big federal green light for self-driving cars this week? Here we are. Let's go to New Orleans and Darren calling on the terror front. Darren, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
So my comment is in response to your question, what do we do to stop the lone wolf bombers? And I think it has to begin with an honest and frank assessment of what the problem is. And at least as far as I see it, the problem is not Muslims per se, not the individuals, but Islam itself. And if you do any amount of studying of Islam and you read the Quran, which I have, and, you know, delve into the Hadith, there are what I would call thought viruses that infect much of Islamic scripture. And it makes, it sanctifies. And this is not, I mean, there's not two sides to this. Straight from the Quran.
But Darren, what do you do with that?
I mean, killing. Sanctifies killing.
I hear what you're saying. I will remind you, you can look in the Bible and find recipes for genocide in there. So it's not the only religion where you can find quite extreme things. But however you interpret it, it's more than a billion people on this planet who follow it. And many of the most prominent ones say, look, this is extremism that misrepresents our religion. What do you do when this is a huge part of our sort of neighbors on this planet, Darren?
I think, again, it has to come back to an honest discussion. And I think the comment that you just made where you're trying to say, well, look, you know, you find the same things in Christianity, I think that's part of the problem because I think it's simply incorrect. Now, you do have bad things in the
check
Old
it
Testament.
Out. Check it out. It's in there. But my question stands. These are not strangers from another planet. These are fellow humans, a lot of them on the earth, and many of the most prominent ones saying, this is not what we stand for. Even if there are problems there, what do you do about it? Darren, let me hold that and get one more. Gabriel in Austin, Texas, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, you're on, Gabriel.
I was thinking that, you know, I don't think Trump's message of fear and hate are going to solve the problem. They're just going to create more terrorists by having Americans hate Muslims, and they're going to in turn hate us, and it'll just escalate, and we'll just create more. It's not the solution. You want to get Muslims, you integrate them in, you say, welcome, we'll work with you, and we'll come to a solution together.
What about our caller who says there's a problem here that's built in to the religion? Do you buy that?
No, I don't buy that because I agree with you. There are built-in problems with Christianity. You can see Christians doing bad things left and right. It's not a religious problem. It's a extremist problem.
I mean, it's hard to know what to believe here. You had the Egyptian leader this week in the U.S. saying we have real problems with extremism in Islam that are different from the mainstream of Islam. Of course, he's got an interest in that as well. Hillary Clinton was quite ready after the bombings in New York and New Jersey to say Donald Trump, with his approach, is helping terror groups by broadly denouncing Muslims.
We know that Donald Trump's comments
have been used online for recruitment of terrorists. We've heard that from former CIA Director Michael Hayden, who made it a very clear point when he said Donald Trump is being used as a recruiting sergeant for the terrorists.
Yoki Driesen, help us think about this in a week when Americans are thinking carefully about what's going on all over the world here and in their own country. I mean, we have a long tradition here of openness and separation of church and state and openness to people of all kinds. People want to make sense out of this. Nobody wants bombs blowing up even in dumpsters in New York and New Jersey.
And I think that the first caller sort of hit on something that is a feeling that's broadly shared. And there is an enormous complexity, Tom. You know, the way you frame the question, I think, is exactly right. And I think there's another question on top of it. If we accept as true the fact that the recent spate of terror attacks here and in Europe have been carried out by Muslims, extremist Muslims, Muslims who share a belief shared only by a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of the billion Muslims on the planet, once you get to that point, then where do you go? You know, the difference, I think, between the United States and Europe, and frankly the reason why the number of attacks here, even though it feels like there are so many, there have not been so many, and they've thankfully not taken many lives, is that we don't ostracize Muslims in the way that much of Europe does. We don't have Muslim ghettos in the way that France does, in the way that parts of Germany do. And that's to the enormous credit of the United States as a place, but also has an enormous life and death difference between the way we live, the way we integrate, and the way Europeans live.
But Yoki, people could listen to you say that, and now, after San Bernardino, and after Orlando, and after New York and New Jersey, start to think, well, maybe that's been true, but does it remain true? Will it remain true?
I think that it will remain true that you won't have bomb after bomb after bomb after bomb. At the same time, I think it will also remain true that when you do have attacks, they will be carried out by Muslims who have become radicalized based on their own beliefs, based on what they've learned, based on what they've seen online and what they've internalized. And I think that's the complexity, because you could have both things simultaneously be true and take you to two very different places. It can be true that the people carrying out terror attacks in the United States are Muslim. It is also true that the overwhelming majority of Muslims in the United States and in the world do not support terrorism. So it ultimately comes back to, I think, regardless of the path you take, it gets down to the same place of what do you do about it. And if you take the first path of just saying Muslims are inherently dangerous, that leads you to the belief that you profile, you keep them out of the country, you stop and frisk Muslims, not just African Americans, you eavesdrop or close down mosques, both things Trump has said. If you take the second part, that there is a teeny minority of Muslims, but Muslims who are carrying out these attacks, that takes you more towards where Hillary Clinton is, which is step up law enforcement, step up intelligence, but don't try to close off this entire community. I think liberals have a problem with the notion that the attacks are being carried out by Muslims, and I think conservatives have a problem with the notion that the Muslims carrying them out are a tiny, tiny fraction of the Muslims in the world.
Jack, I mean, it seems to come down to a couple of things here. One is characterizing, whether it's abroad or at home, the state of the world. Is it manageable? Is it okay? Is it even improving? In many ways, you've had Barack Obama assert in recent weeks as he's lined up behind Hillary Clinton. Or is it in chaos and crisis? You know, and that broad brush is out in Donald Trump's hands, certainly these days. And at the same time, Jack, there's this issue of effective response. However you see what's going on, if you don't have effective response over time, the temptation to go for that meat axe response becomes larger, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Michael Chertoff, who was George Bush's Homeland Security Secretary, spoke to this week, spoke to Mr. Trump's nostrum of ethnic profiling. He said, not only is it a waste of time, but you're offending people who in many ways you want to be your allies. When you ethnically profile, you play into the hands of the enemy. And I think that gets at the issue of efficacy. If the effect of sort of demonizing a whole religion is to essentially create solidarities of silence in that religion here, that will work against any effort to try to deal with this problem of self-radicalization. Now, Hillary Clinton has apparently pointed to programs in four different cities in the United States that show promise of the Muslim communities there sort of being forward and coming forth and saying, here's somebody we see who might be in trouble. And that seems to be working. And I think she's proposing we need that sort of nationally. That's her solution. Let's look at how we integrate our Muslim communities in the common effort to protect us against terrorism.
But Dan, I mean, you look around, look at Minnesota this week, and the Somali who went into the shopping mall and the knife came out, and I mean, just, you know, was it 10 people that were stabbed before that was brought to an end? You can cite individual cases. People want some kind of clarity. The Obama administration even wanted to talk about Islamic extremism. Is that too broad a brush, Jack, or is it time for that? I mean, that's what you have Muslims saying. Let's talk about the extremists here because they plague us.
Yes, I think, but the president has said, and it seems to me a pretty sound foreign policy reason, if you say Islamic extremism, you're immediately prejudicing our diplomacy and the pursuit of our national interest in the Middle East. Yes, it may make you feel better and you're truth-telling, but it may hurt our interest abroad because it, of course, people hear it for what it is, a kind of slur.
There's a kind of, yes, there's diplomacy going on, but there's tough stuff going on as well. Lots of bombs flying this week in Syria. President Obama, before the UN, his last appearance before the UN, saying we've got to work together. You heard him there at the top of the hour, or we're going to get into some really sharp conflicts. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. As I listen to President Obama's speech to the United Nations, I wonder what it would be like for Donald Trump to give a similar speech like that. And I think with his lack of experience, it would be an embarrassment to our country. And I think I think our voters need to think about that. Thank you.
Jim, I appreciate your call. Yoki, talk to us about how diplomacy is working out on the other hand. John Kerry's been out, you know, calling and calling and working for a ceasefire, for some kind of negotiated deal in Syria. But this week we saw that convoy just bombed to pieces there, the U.S. accusing Russia of doing that. We saw the Syrian leader out denying and pointing a finger at the U.S. Are John Kerry's efforts finding any kind of real traction? Is it worth these efforts if they're not? He says, what's the alternative? But is the U.S. being played? What is going on, Yoki?
I think that the diplomacy, unfortunately, is not paying any dividends. And the problem ultimately is that the White House is all in on diplomacy. There had been talk in the Pentagon and elsewhere of a second option, a second plan, which would have been massively ramping up military aid and training to the various rebel groups, Syrian Kurds, Iraqi Kurds, others who are fighting ISIS. But that never really went anywhere. There's talk now, just this week, of directly arming Kurdish forces that are Syrian Kurds rather than Iraqi Kurds, which would risk alienating Turkey. But John Kerry is trying diplomacy because that is what Washington has convinced itself is the only path. Unfortunately, what Russia has shown is that it isn't the only path. When the White House was asked 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, why not intervene militarily? The response back was, it's a slippery slope. And once you intervene, you end up with something that might look like Iraq. What Vladimir Putin has shown is if you intervene, and frankly, if you don't mind collateral damage, if you don't mind killing doctors and aid workers, that you can intervene in a limited way and have enormous impact. He started to bomb on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad now is stronger than he's been at any point in the last 5 years. So unfortunately, I think we have been played to a degree, but it may be that we've sort of boxed ourselves into that same trap. We've convinced ourselves there's one option. There has always been more than one, and Russia has taken advantage of one we didn't want to use.
Related to that, could you speak for a moment, Yoki, to the bill that the President Obama likely vetoing at some point today, by the time some of our listeners hear this, he may have vetoed it, that would allow American victims in the 9/11 attacks to sue Saudi Arabia. Why is he so determined to veto that? What are the potential? Is it about international law? Is it about relations with the Saudis? What's really at play there?
I think it's about both. And it is really fascinating that 15 years after 9/11, that there is still parts of it that are not known. And there is still this unresolved question of, if we accept that Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabians, more crucially, knew more about the attacks, may have contributed financially to the attacks, how do you respond? And for the White House, they're worried that on the one hand, this potentially could open up U.S. allies to other lawsuits filed by victims of other terror attacks, and much more that when we need Saudi Arabia the most, and frankly when we need the Arab world the most because of the Islamic State, and that Arab world is already feeling alienated by Donald Trump, even though people there realize that Donald Trump is not Barack Obama. But when you have those two things happening, the very last thing you want to do is open the door to lawsuits that could push those Arab allies even further away.
That playing out on this very day. And then, of course, we had the head of Wells Fargo, CEO John Stumpf, in the hot seat this week before the Senate Banking Committee on Tuesday. Here was Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, going after him on his company's fraudulent accounts controversy. They were opening up accounts for people who hadn't asked for them.
Did you fire any of those people? No. Okay. So you haven't resigned. You haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings. You haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently, your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees. It's gutless leadership.
That's full-on attack there. Of course, he's headed out with, I forget what it was, $180 million or something. I mean, that's almost as big as the penalty that the federal government leveled there. Janelle Ross, this drumbeat of criticism against top bankers goes on, but yet the scandals keep coming out.
True indeed. At the same time, I suppose, in much the same way as our earlier discussion regarding police activities in the United States, perhaps some of this is a function of increased attention and or oversight of banking activities. But it does seem that some of the same themes recur over and over again.
Jack Beatty, Monday night. We've got the debates coming up. We have these two candidates now looking at all these events right under our feet and preparing to meet one another head on. Do you expect that what we've seen this week in Charlotte, in Syria, in New York is going to inform the debates on Monday?
I expect it will, and I just don't want the debate moderator to disarm himself ahead of time. Mr. Trump has said he doesn't want fact-checking from the debate moderator. We saw that. The lack of that with Matt Lauer, where he let Mr. Trump lie about Iraq and other things. And I think that would be a disservice to journalism and certainly to the electorate.
NBC's Lester Holt in the seat moderating the debate on Monday night.
Yes, indeed. And it's a big moment for him.
We'll talk about what's coming in the debate prep, what we may see Monday night, right here on Monday. Listeners, thanks very much for being with us, and all to my panel today. Thank you as well. Janelle Ross, political reporter at The Washington Post. It's terrific to have you in this week. Janelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yoki Driesen, deputy managing editor and foreign editor at Vox. Yoki, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Jack, thank you as always. Great to have you right here.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation as always and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio, Facebook, the same. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook NPR. This is On Point.